With me in the studio is Ethel Williams, who I'm very excited to have here in the studio because I've often chatted to you and it's been on the telephone.
That's true. We've spoken a few times and yes. So it's wonderful to be sitting face to face with you, Lindsay, finally.
And last time I wanted to reach out to you because you were overseas in a delivering a poetry. I don't know. I can't even remember what it was.
Was
it a poetry convention?
It was. Actually, there were in two places.
So I mean, I remember Colombo.
Yes.
And then you were off to India.
Yeah, that's right. In Bangalore.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So in India was the Bangalore Literature Festival, where
yes.
I was invited. And then in Sri Lanka is Colombo, exactly as
yes.
you say. And it was all linked to, there was a poem I had published called Erased in an anthology about descendants of Indian indenture. Which on my father's side is my sort of ancestry.
Okay.
And they saw this poem and invited me to come and share the poem, which is a long way to travel to go and share one poem.
It's a hell of a long way to go. But yeah. I mean, I think that's just what you're about. I just so get that it's something that you would do.
Oh, absolutely. And for me, it was firstly the honor of being recognized in that way and saying, you know, we want you to come and share this important poem with us.
Yes.
But for me, it's that the joy of engaging with people around similar ideas.
Yes.
And I think in South Africa, we're doing more and more about understanding our history, which is fantastic.
Mm.
Apparently in India and Sri Lanka, not as much. And so it was kind of ironic in a way to have a South African go over there, and share my background and my story, and then read this poem as a way to spark their interest in Indian indenture.
But, I mean, ironies abound. I mean, I think in South Africa, there's a sense that somehow we are this nation that's often undersold, if you like.
I absolutely agree. What's so interesting, even being in Sri Lanka, the topic most people asked me about was the TRC. And I didn't know enough about Sri Lankan history to appreciate that. But they'd just come out of a 30-year civil war. And so for them, there was a lot of this thinking around reparations and how are we going to move past
Colombo,
this?
Isn't it the Tamil Tigers?
Tamil Tigers was kind of north of Sri Lanka. So I'd also heard those phrases, but
yes.
didn't really appreciate
yes.
that it's actually been emerging from a civil war.
Yes.
And so they get, you know, we often have the reference of apartheid, pre-apartheid,
yes.
post-apartheid.
Yes.
And for them, there was the war, right?
Yes.
And they were just intrigued by how South Africa had set up the TRC, how it worked, and wanted my views of whether I thought it was a good thing or bad thing, or not a bad thing, how effective it had been.
Yes.
And I said there were parts which were effective and parts which I didn't think were effective. But they did look to us as this beacon of a society that have walked paths that everyone else is kind of still needing to tread.
And I suppose, you know, we always think of ourselves as a developing nature.
Yeah.
And We of course forged a whole new beginning there.
Yeah.
Many would contradict that it was a beginning worth starting.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly.
But you know, the idea of focusing on where we're going and really looking at forgiveness and moving
yeah.
forward.
Yeah.
But still understanding the pain of what we've gone through.
It's exactly
I think is something that you're quite well rooted in.
You know, I often wished I'd been born sort of 15 years earlier because I might have been more involved in the freedom struggle, right? So, you know, I could have spent at least, you know, 2 or 3 years on the island to kind of have those credentials, right? But equally, I'm sort of glad that I was born in the time when I was because I'd experienced some of the pain and struggle of apartheid, but not to the extent that I couldn't ever escape it.
And we right. can't escape it.
No,
we've all inherited it.
Absolutely.
Whether you like it. I might not like my white privilege.
Yeah.
But boy, I have to wear it.
But I think there are a lot of people, Lindsay, you haven't moved beyond that.
Yes.
Right? And so I think there are some of us who say, we experienced it. It was real, regardless of which side you were. But we somehow need to move forward now.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And not forget the past. Let's kind of learn from the past, but then
yes.
kind of move somewhere forward.
Yes.
And I think, a lot of my poetry, a lot of my writing, a lot of my community development work is rooted in that past.
Yes.
But saying I'm not going to get stuck there in the past and get stuck in the despair. I'm going to use that despair to inspire me, but I'm going to move towards hope.
Yes.
And I
yes.
think that's where it's
we forget how much other countries need that.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
And I think you don't need to have been in the thick of the struggle to live the pain and the consequences
exactly.
of the struggle.
Yeah.
And you're somebody who've used life as it was thrown of you, and actually has forged away and shown people that it is possible to transcend that.
I think so. I mean, I've certainly tried that. And as you say, I've used a lot of my own personal experience, so personal pain and personal pushing aside of boulders, to use my analogy from my autobiography. But also I've, in speaking to other people, I think the moment you open yourself to the pain and struggle of others, I think you see yourself and you see the world very differently. So the struggle of women, for example, right? I've you know, been to women's prisons. I've tried to listen as much as I can to the struggle women face in terms of glass ceilings, in terms of the violence women face. And so I can never experience that pain and fear myself, but I can listen, and have that seep into my consciousness and have it seep into my work. And I think,
and that's what was at the core of the TRC, to listen.
I think
to hear it.
I think so.
Whether people heard it or not,
that,
of course, is another story.
Exactly. And I think that's what we lack a lot. And it's interesting, a lot of my writing in my poetry is about this idea of listening, of creating silence, because I don't think we listen deeply enough, right? Yes. Because we
are so kind of stuck in our lenses.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I think part of it is to understand that we all have a lens, and it's okay
absolutely.
To have a lens.
Absolutely.
But so we like have to get over ourselves.
No, but exactly. Yeah. So I think start with the lens and then listen, right?
Yes.
Because then you can tweak that lens and move that lens left and right.
Yes.
I like the idea of putting a stake in the ground, saying, this is what I believe, right? Let me take a stand and then listen and learn about new things and then adjust as I go along. I think sometimes people are too afraid to even express their view. Right. So I've got this view, for example, that says, hey, you know, I grew up in apartheid, so I can't deny I've got some element of racism somewhere in my psychology.
Mm.
So I want to say, you know, hi, I'm Athol. I'm racist.
Yeah.
Right. But what we do now is we point at Athol and say, he's racist. You know, let's beat him up. As opposed to saying, how do we help him? Right.
Mm-hmm.
How do we help the racist? How do we help the sexist?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I think we become so hung up on pointing out and calling out the people who are racist or sexist, but not enough in terms of how do we help them move from where they are.
Yes.
And I think often they must do a lot of work themselves, but there is something we can do to help them.
Well, and also, you're somebody who's studied, you know, as I say, you're probably the only person who's studied in all these big five universities. So you're also rooted in the think tank.
Yeah.
And understand global economics.
Yeah.
You also understand, so you're somebody who kind of has a real big picture view of things, which I think also adds to your humanity in a way, because, you know, you can live in the moment, but also have a sense of the big picture.
Yeah. You know what, Lindsay, what it's given me, I think a heightened sense of compassion, because that understanding, as you say, of economics, of finance, of philosophy, of politics, you know, I went into those areas thinking, I'm going to find the answer, right?
Yes.
I thought the answer's in economics, surely. And I didn't find the answer. I thought, surely the answer's in politics. I didn't find it there.
Yes.
And so I've been looking for the answer. And what you discover, actually, the answer isn't in any of those areas. But the point is, we get along as fellow humans in a society, where we are fallible, we make mistakes, we haven't got it all right. But the moment we come to each other in compassion, I think that's when you can begin to listen better and find the solutions. So the solutions is not in the universities or in the textbooks.
Yeah.
But for me, those
it's listening to people.
It's in our human connection. It seems so absolute. Yeah. It is in our human connection.
See, now that I've got you here in the studio, I'm wanting your wife to take pictures of the hands, because the listeners can't see my hands. And I'm wanting them to be captured.
And the hands are part of the words.
Well, it is. It's about the expression.
Yeah, that's exactly.
You know. I want to come back to the poetry, because poems, I mean, I know you're passionate also about writing, about reading. It's a form of connecting in a different kind of plane.
Yes.
And sometimes we can connect in a way that we're not prepared to see. So we can sometimes see around the lens.
Yes. Yeah, no, you're right. Yes.
It kind of offers us a little corner mirror.
Yeah.
Often.
Yeah.
That sometimes we kind of, perhaps without that, we might not have seen as much.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
And I think also the thing about being somebody who's had such a global experience is that you don't kind of get stuck on what's going on here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
this experience reminds you, I mean, that you were offered almost as an expert. And you can say, hang on, but in South Africa we've got such problems.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a place that isn't stuck.
Absolutely.
With the kind of geopolitical, psychological, philosophical mess that we find ourselves in around the world.
Yeah.
And great minds with all the great expertise haven't found that solution.
Yeah.
You, as you say, you don't find it in books. And if it was that simple, well, somebody would have fixed it.
Completely agree. Yeah. It's exactly that. So I like the idea of the academic rigor or theoretical rigor because it's helped me think deeply about problems.
Yes.
And I think we need that. I think often we deal with our challenges in a very superficial way,
yes.
right? So this idea of, you know, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy,
yeah.
as opposed to thinking, how do we solve this problem? How do I understand why you've got a different view to me?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And is there a third view? And I like this idea of saying, you know, I've got my view, there's your view, and then there might be the right view.
I mean, even when we think of something like climate change, I read something recently about how we express that, you know, when we are so judgmental and so we fear monger, we're not going to get the kind of change we affect.
Absolutely.
And so sometimes people suggest it's too vague and too scary and people just shut down and don't do anything.
People disengage. Yeah.
And to come to the table and think of a practical thing and say, educate a girl child.
Yes.
Because there's more of a correlation with a possible change. And you think, how did that happen?
Where did that come from?
We started talking about climate and you're coming with educate a girl child.
It's exactly.
And so what I love with the work that you've done, you've eschewed all the fancy glitz and glamour, which you could have stepped into in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And you've come back and you've actually found a way to say, hang on, reading. Reading is the passport
Absolutely.
To our future.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's not poetry, it's books.
No, it's
and
books.
You've come and you've said, we need youngsters to read.
It's exactly that. And it seems, again, there are these simple things.
Yeah.
I like going back to first principles
yeah.
and saying, how do we build from the ground up?
Yeah.
You know, and people often say to us with Read Your Eyes, why don't you give the children tablets and, you know, iPads and,
yeah.
you know.
And Six legs.
No, that's exactly.
Yeah.
Look, let's get back down to basics, right? Yeah. If children aren't reading, we need to get back
down
to basics.
Because they don't have a love of reading.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's exactly what we do, Lindsay, is about getting a love for reading.
Yeah.
But also importantly, begin to share some of the messages, I think, which builds a hopeful and constructive society.
Yeah.
So we don't go in our, you know, our stories, we don't talk about, there's no violence, there's no racial stereotypes and gender stereotypes, you know, all the heroes aren't boys. And we try to build up rather than kind of say don't. So there's this whole thing of, you know, don't do that, don't do that. Let's be anti-bullying, anti-gender violence, anti-drugs, and we're none of that.
Yes.
So we say rather have self-respect, right?
Yes.
Have compassion. Know what makes you happy. To talk to a child about what makes them happy and say, pursue that.
Yes.
I think it's a powerful idea.
Yes.
And so, linked to my ideas around poetry, my ideas around philosophy, we've built all of it into the stories, these Oaky books.
Yeah, yeah. And your new book, The Invitation, I see you brought one with you.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And Invitation is exactly that. It's an invitation to go on a journey.
Yes.
It's not a book that says, here's the answer again.
Yes.
It's almost saying, I don't know, but how about we hold hands and walk together and try and figure this out?
And I think it's, you know, having been rooted in education myself, there's something about the idea that we actually can't fix the future because the future is unknown.
Yeah.
And the problems we have haven't actually been established. They are of our making right now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's why people get so stuck on education. Education is not finding the answer. Education is knowing that it's about collaboration. And finding, alternatives.
I completely agree. No, I think that's an important
point. Having not the answer, but several.
Or learning how to find the answer rather than finding the answer.
Yes.
So for me, education is less about the what as the how, right?
Yes.
So I don't
have that whole open book.
Completely.
We'll give you the book. You know, you don't have to learn the book.
Yeah.
But now we want to know how you're going to use the book.
I think that's exactly right.
To face the unknown.
And I think
that's where we're going.
And I think that's the difficulty we've got right now where we've got access to so much information.
Yes.
If we're not training our children or our young people on how to use all that information, I think it becomes just a wall for them.
Yeah.
It's too overwhelming, too intimidating.
Yeah.
So for me, I think education needs to focus far more on how to think, how to solve problems than to present content.
Yes. Yes.
And unfortunately, the opposite happens in our schools,
right?
Where we take this view that a child is an empty vessel we must fill with information.
And it closes down. Rather than opens up.
That's exactly.
And especially with girl children, and that's a societal pressure where young women and girls are closing down. They don't want to be seen to be too smart because it's not sexy. And they think, oh no.
Please.
And we can't, you know, you can't change everything. So I like your approach is simplification.
Yeah.
But we've taken a very circular route because we're focusing on the poetry here.
We can focus wherever we need to.
Can you maybe share the poem? Because I think because there's something, the poem got you there, and there's a lovely story behind it.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. So let's let's sit with the poem for a while. And then I want to hear also more about, you know, your experience, what it was like to travel. I know it was a little bit of a blur at times. I wanted to chat with you while you were there.
Exactly.
And of course, yeah, jet lag, wada, didn't always work out. And I knew it could wait.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's a bit of a long poem. Should I just probably read?
You just read whatever you know the poem well enough.
Let me, I'll just read the last few lines.
Okay.
And maybe, so the poem's called Erased.
Okay.
And it's this idea that, When people are moved from one place to another, so whether it's through slavery, whether it's human trafficking, whether it's forced labor, their history is often lost, right? And this poem called Erased talks about the fact that, you know, your history, of your language, of your religion, of where you're from is lost. Yes. And in my case, I said on my father's side, my paternal background, was through indentured labor. And so we don't know where my family's really from. Even my surname Williams is fabricated because my grandfather had the surname Balakrishnan, which even that was a distortion of Balakrishnan, which was the real family surname.
Oh, okay.
So they came over in a boat from India. You know, some administrator at the port kind of asked, obviously, what's your name? He said Balakrishnan. He heard
and
it as Balakrishnan. Right.
Yeah.
And then in the early 1900s, when my grandfather was based in the Transvaal, and there were better economic opportunities, interestingly, if he could be classified as colored and be in the Western Cape, right? And so that's what he did. He was fairly sort of light-skinned. There were Tamils from Tamil Nadu. Mm-hmm. And so he moved to the Cape, but said, I've got to change the surname, right? And so he sort of, for some reason, saw Williams as a common surname, and so changed his surname to Williams. And so all of his descendants are Williams. All the rest of my family are Balakrishnan. But even that, right, our name, our identity, our belonging, you say, is you're sort of robbed of that.
Yes.
And so I'll just read the last few lines of this poem that sort of is a young boy asking his father, you know, where are we from? And the father, and the young boy says, you know, I know we're from Madras in India. And of course, Madras is now called Chennai. Mm. And so this is the father telling him, look, on the map, you know, Madras doesn't even exist. And this is part of the other idea of shame that I talk a lot about in terms of where we come from, right? So to say you're a descendant of slaves, you know, a lot of people find, you know, great shame in that. And so we've erased even that story. Right? So we kind of, we wash over it and we tell a different story. So we, you know, no one's a descendant of slaves. And I sort of wanted to say proudly, that's my history. It is what it is. It doesn't define who I am necessarily, but it just is what it is. So the last few lines of the poem go, one day he showed me a map of India. See, there is no Madras. But I knew the truth. Madras was erased, wiped from the map, like our dreams, like our house in District 6. Erased, like our name, our tongue.
So much there.
Yeah.
The tongue, how we speak. District 6, of course, bringing us right back to Cape Town.
Exactly.
So much pain. I mean, right now we've got all the stuff happening in the Boer Kaap as well.
Completely.
You know, it's... For me, the irony is that you can't erase that because it's in your blood, it's in your soul.
Yeah.
But there is something in the way that it... It kind of wipes away the glow that's naturally there.
Yeah. And I think in, you know, in South Africa's history, I'm talking about our recent history, has been such a mixed bag. On the one hand, we've done amazingly powerful, profound things.
Yes.
And then we've also just mixed in there just some of the ugliest, most despicable things, right? So just our levels of violence, our corruption are just despicable things. But yet we've done beautiful things about, you know, even just remembering our history. So, you know, the Slave Lodge or the District 6 Museum or, in Durban now, there's a heritage center called the 1860 Heritage Center, which remembers when the first Indian indentured laborers came over. So I think we've been good about remembering our history and facing it. I think facing difficult parts of the history. You talked earlier about being a white South African. Well, I think there's we've looked each other in the face and says, well, you know, that is the history. Now what do we do going forward? And for me, this idea of privilege only matters for me. What matters is how you use that privilege, right? But also how you define privilege. In many ways, I say I'm privileged in that I had both parents growing up.
Yeah.
And there are many people, regardless of wealth, who didn't have that.
Yeah.
I had healthy parents. I had a father who encouraged me to read. And so for me, that's profound privilege.
Yes. And it's interesting. I mean, the Glass Castle, I was thinking that is a book about somebody who had a despicable childhood. You know, ironically, almost the white trash version of that. But through all their not having food and running, you know, and having to be on the skedaddle, their parents taught them the love of reading.
Yeah.
And that was the passport.
It's a passport. I like that phrase, passport.
Because at some point you say, I am not defined by that.
Yeah.
And, you know, then they were all able to move out of that dreadful cycle of poverty that most people get stuck in.
Yeah. You know, I've been thinking deeply about this idea of what development should look like, right? Yeah. So we have these terms, developed world and developing world. And it's sort of this idea that there's part of the world that's developed and the rest of us are kind of trying to catch up, right? Or we're trying to become like them. And I think it should be, I think it's a perversity in a way, because what we're doing is we are defining what happiness or good life is. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we know that. So if you look at what the World Bank might define as a good life, they're probably going to say, I need a television and a fridge and a stove, and that's a good life. And I think there are many parts of the world, and I think some of our African heritage tells us, we don't need a TV and a fridge and a stove to have a good life. And so this idea of us all moving in this direction to become more civilized, in quotes, to be more westernized, I think it's massively mistaken. And so I'm trying to think about, can we articulate what a good life is, not in material terms? Right? So I was talking about, you know, there's the Forbes, you know, wealthiest, you know, list.
Yes.
What about the Forbes happiest people list? Right? Yes. Because you can be so sure the people living with all the wealth in, you know, in downtown Manhattan are not necessarily happier.
Well, bring it even home.
Yeah.
You know, people who live, often inside a prison.
Yeah.
Of their own wealth.
Exactly.
So, you know, we also can't forget the power of wealth to also shift and change things.
Agreed.
You know.
And so I think it depends on where you are on the income scale in a way.
Yes.
It's often been shown that, you know, someone's got nothing, having more money does make your life better, obviously.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it gets to a point where you kind of go, actually having an extra thousand rand doesn't make your life any better.
Yeah.
But we just meaninglessly pursue that.
Yes.
And that was one of the challenges I faced personally. Was, you know, I felt because I'd grown up in Mitchell's Plain and struggled and was homeless and lived in charity for a while, that I was due the fruits of my labor, that I should enjoy the cars and the wealth that came with my success. But it was, you know, I was challenged by those words of Mandela, who said, right, to be free is not merely to cast off your own chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. And so, you know, I paraphrase that to mean, I'm not free until we all are free.
Yeah.
And that's what really challenged me
would set you up for a lifelong challenge.
Absolutely, you know? Because you never get there, You never get there.
And the truth is that, I mean, it's also, you know, freedom, you know, it's about goals, it's about hope, and it's about moving forward. We might not get there, but we can get so bogged down in South Africa.
Yeah.
With the
yeah. But I think also in South Africa, we're holding on this fear. I think our society, our psychology is dominated by fear, right? I think those who have, are trying to hold on to it because we're afraid it's going to be taken away.
Yeah.
Those who don't have are afraid they never will have.
Yeah.
And so we've got this fear of violence. We've got this fear of, you know, our land being taken, our jobs being taken. Yeah. We fear of our children. And fear is a corrosive emotion because it robs us, I think, of our humanity, right? So why don't I stop on the side of the street when I see someone hitchhiking? Because I'm worried that it's a setup and he's going to attack me, right?
Yeah.
So I don't act. We talked earlier about this connection between humans, and yet I'm forced, because I live in South Africa, to often forego those connections.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I used to hitchhike around Africa, around in Europe.
Yeah.
And you never know what's going to happen. Sadly, I think times have changed.
I think they have, yeah.
You know, so there is a sort of closing down that provides, but that's what fear-mongering does.
That's exactly.
It's about shutting down.
And I want to change that. So.
And what's so exciting is to come back to your poetry and being in Colombo and Bangalore is a sense of they're looking to us, riddled with imperfection, as a country that's trying something different.
Yeah.
And we forget, because we're so busy living it.
Yes.
The amazing stories.
Yeah.
And we do get stuck in the fear sometimes.
I completely agree.
And we forget
agree.
The wondrous stories.
I think it's exactly right. You know. I mean, I was so happy to come back home.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, India and Sri Lanka have got massive, you know, infrastructure challenges.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
The weather for me wasn't great because it's so humid. And so I was so happy to come home.
Yes.
But also just realizing, you know, our infrastructure largely works. Yes, there are potholes. But our infrastructure works compared to theirs.
Yes,
our society sort of works. You know, the rules work.
There's a complexity of society. And yet, the simplicity of how people live in those places.
Exactly.
I mean, I haven't been to either. I've been to the east, but I know a friend who lived in Colombo.
Yeah.
And he says it's more than the Tamil Tigers.
Yeah, no,
you know,
far more.
I mean,
yeah.
There's such a wonderful spirit there.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. And but it just proves we can learn so much from each other.
And
right?
What was it like for you to be there and have a sense, that, hey, this is where I'm rooted somehow?
Yeah. It is quite a profound sort of feeling. Mm. I think even just looking, I thought I'm going to sort of stand out, and I didn't, you know, in a way people sort of didn't look at me kind of strangely. I remember one young woman at the Bangalore Literature Festival saying, it's so great talking to me. She feels like she's talking to her uncle, right? But it was that sense of, I felt I belonged in a way.
Yeah.
And not in a sort of superficial way, but it was a sense of belonging.
Mm.
And it was great that others recognized that as well.
What was the connection with Colombo, Sri Lanka, and India?
So it was. So
I mean, how did they talk to each other? I mean, is it just some literary festival kind of hookup?
It was. So it was linked to this book. So this book is called We Mark Your Memory,
okay,
which was an anthology published by the Commonwealth Foundation in the UK, and they invited people of Indian descent to write poems. And the people from Sri Lanka, because there were Indian indentured laborers taken to Sri Lanka as well.
Yes, we forget that.
Is, exactly.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So in Sri Lanka, they've got, you know, a whole portion of their population as descendants of Indian indenture. You know, we've got 152,000 who came to South Africa initially. And so it was linked to that idea. So even the event I had in Colombo, the audience were mainly people of Indian descent, and therefore indenture descent. Sort of reflecting upon on the past in different ways.
Mm.
Because in Sri Lanka, a lot of they still have plantations. Because in South Africa, we've kind of rid ourselves of some of the sort of slavery conditions. But in Sri Lanka, not. So the literal people living in plantations were descendants of Indians who don't even have citizenship in
sure.
Sri Lanka.
Sure.
So it was pretty intense there.
And there's something also about traveling that you are reminded that wherever you go, there are large communities that are brought in to do the grunt work.
Yeah, that's exactly that. And it's a good reminder.
I mean,
it's a very good reminder.
In Thailand, it's people from the Philippines.
Same, exactly.
How does that happen?
Yeah,
you know?
That's exactly
that.
You know, I often, when I travel to the West and I come back home, I often think there's such great possibility, right? So you walk around England and you can walk around with safety and worrying about, you know, looking over your shoulder. And so I come back here with hope, thinking our country can be so much better.
Mm.
And then, you know, going to Sri Lanka and India, where in many ways I think they're worse off than us, I sort of felt, well, you know, we get a lot right here as well.
Yes.
And so we should celebrate some of those things we got right as well, whilst learning from others.
Yeah. Of course, the scary thing is we don't know how tenuous that foundation
no,
is.
No, exactly.
Okay.
And look, we've been chipping away at it, right?
Yeah.
We started with
yeah.
an amazing foundation.
Yes.
And we've been chipping at it.
Now, your wife recently went to the United Nations.
She went to the United States, not the United Nations.
Oh, I got the United Nations as part of that. So I don't know how I managed that.
It was, so she was selected as the Obama Foundation created a program in Africa where they selected 200 young Africans from across the continent doing community and social development work. And Taryn runs Read to Rise. So I get a lot of credit for Read to Rise, but she actually does all the work. So Taryn runs it on 100%, you know, full-time basis. So she quit her corporate job to run Read to Rise. And from the 200 African Obama leaders, they then chose a smaller group of 11 who then went over to Chicago, which is Obama's hometown, to bring together these people from across the world around sharing ideas of how grassroots level you can change a society. And I think it's quite profound to have young people have the agency and the skills to begin to say, we won't just accept the way our societies are, right? As young people, we're going to actively do things to change our societies.
Mm.
And that's what Taryn's been involved in. In fact, this coming week, the next Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm facilitating a number of sessions with a few of the Obama leaders in Cape Town with a community chest, going around parts of Cape Town, to Langa, to Mitchell's Plain, to Boerkop, where they've had unrest recently, and being to talk to community leaders and say, how do we then get ourselves organized to make the change we need?
Mm. It was also interesting. I recently went on a trip with some people from Israel, and they had a program which was a collaboration of Israelis and Palestinians.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And they were coming here. And you think, You know, they're coming here. You know, once again. And we forget, you know, we always think that everyone else is sorted.
Yeah, no, it's exactly that.
And it's the whole idea of we need to have dialogue and we need to come together because our problems are bigger than just what we think.
And I think we underestimate the power of that dialogue.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I'm always wanting to find what's the answer, right? As I said earlier.
Yeah.
But sometimes we need the patience to say, let's spend time human to human. Let's just have dialogue.
Yeah.
Now, I remember visiting Northern Ireland a year or two ago, and they had said in terms of their reparations and their TRC equivalent, they talked about how they invited people to the table, but they said, don't come to the table to heal your pain. Come to the table to build relationship with others, right? Because you can't expect the person sitting across from the table from you to heal your pain, but you can build a relationship with them. And as you're building a relationship with the person on the other end of the conflict, right, eventually pain might be healed.
And who would have thought? I mean, Ireland, you know, and the troubles they had would be a place that surged.
Yeah, it's exactly. And I think in South Africa right now, we are trying to heal our pain by interacting, right? I want to meet with you and say, well, I'm suffering because of you, and you must now give me something to make my suffering go away. And I understand the desperation a lot of people face, but I think we're building the relationships, and I think our society is beginning to fracture because we're all looking at each other with distrust. We're all looking at each other as you must solve my problem, as opposed to saying let's build a relationship and solve it together. Yeah. Which sounds very sort of pie in the sky kind of stuff, but I think that's how society moves forward.
In many ways, we've done that. I mean, Cape Town, we do it in so many pockets that we don't know we're doing it.
Yeah. But I think you're right, in pockets. I think there are also large parts where we just let ourselves down, right? I mean, we've got Blikkiesdorp, where people have been living in tin shacks for how many years?
Yes.
You drive down most of the streets, you know, go down to the Cape Flats, and people are living in shacks along the sides of the streets, kids running around in sort of stagnant water. I want to start there and say, let's make a commitment that says in 5 years' time, not a single person in the Cape is living in a shack.
Yeah.
Right? And then work back from that. And I know it's complicated and people coming from the Eastern Cape, etc. But this idea of human dignity, right? I want to live in a society where no woman has to walk at night afraid, because around her people are going to, attack her.
Yeah.
And it breaks my heart. Like I've spoken
to. And of course, the whole story of white farmer genocide.
Yeah.
So sad because of the life that people live day to day.
Absolutely.
And, you just have to walk in younger and, it's a sobering thing.
It's the same idea of the fear, right?
Yeah.
So we're all afraid for different reasons, but we're all living in fear.
Yeah.
But in
that fear, you know, some people say, Lindsay, how can you walk in younger? How can you, and when I was working in Googs, they would say, Lindsay, you shouldn't walk around the streets.
Yeah.
And you have no idea. I said, first of all, I carry a white privilege that, in tough times, I've driven at night in the townships when there's fire in the road,
right,
and you still get given white privilege.
Right. Yes.
You think the converse would happen. It doesn't.
Probably not. Yes. Exactly.
Even in hitchhiking.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
We've got to protect the whitey. It still happens.
Yeah. You're right.
But there's a generosity of spirit, and somehow you get to know a place better when you walk the streets.
That's exactly.
And that's, for me, the biggest pain of apartheid was keeping people apart.
Absolutely.
Because when you go there, you realize, hey, everyone's just living,
just
trying
like
to get
you.
By. You
and
know?
You ask them what their dreams are for themselves and their children. It's the same no matter who they
are. Exactly.
Because interesting apartheid, in fact, Tara and I were talking about this today, this idea of apartheid not only kept us apart, but criminalized us getting together.
And of course, the stereotypes abound.
Yeah.
And stereotypes close us down.
And so I've got a view that says each of us have got almost an equal propensity to do good or bad. So I don't buy this idea of, these evil people and these good people. I think we've got equal propensity. Every decision I make, every action I take. And I think the more and more I live in an environment where I see other positive examples and positive role models and positive energy, I'll choose to make the more positive choice, right? So someone who grows up in an environment like parts of the Cape Flats where everyone around them, everything they see is violence, everything they see is drug abuse, right? Can we blame them for them also falling into that trap?
Yeah.
Right? I still believe each of us must make our own choices.
Yeah. And I want to come back to the word you said, dignity.
Yeah. And I can understand.
I mean, that's also, for me, the criminality of apartheid was the lack of dignity with which people were treated.
And the stripping of it. The stripping of it,
and you've got to then find your dignity before you can even start.
Exactly.
At the beginning line.
Yeah.
And then some.
Yeah.
And I just love that so many people are growing into their skins and finding that sense of dignity, because the truth is that in absence of other people giving it to you, you've got to find it yourself.
Absolutely. I love this. You know, there was a few years ago, I used for business, I had a driver who drove me to the airport back and forth. And I asked him, the one day he was talking about how great South Africa is. And I said to him, you know, Meshack, you live in Tembisa, not a great area, right? Your kids are still struggling. You tell me how you struggle at home. How is it you think South Africa is so great? And he talked about dignity. He said, you know, Athol, for the first time after apartheid, I can actually walk on the side of the street and feel I belong there, right? I can hold my head up high and not have anyone sort of tell me I don't belong here. And I think that's an idea of dignity where we had stripped it away from people for so many ways. And I can assume that position of dignity of my humanity without needing all the material stuff, right?
And I think dignity also allows us to hold our beliefs. But it allows us to hear that other people have beliefs that are so different to ours, but respect them.
That's exactly.
We don't have to have them. We just need to respect them.
Yeah. And that's the idea of tolerance and the idea of compassion again. You know, I've been a vegan for the last 6 years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so no meat, you know, no animal products, no leather shoes, no anything.
Okay.
But I've seen so many people get into these fights about, you know, compassion for animals and all the rest of it. And I don't preach it, right? My family eat meat and eat, you know, and we respect each other. So when I'll come around, I'll say I wouldn't eat the meat. And they carry on, right? Yeah. And so it's a choice you then make. So for me, the idea of saying, I believe passionately that we shouldn't be eating meat. But if you've chosen that consciously, you choose that I respect you. Then we can live side by side.
Well, I know some people say, Lindsay, you're vegetarian. And in fact, one friend came to a party and she bought a salami and everyone said, does she not know Lindsay's a vegetarian? And so there's somebody says, she knows that Lindsay's got a sense of humor.
And
everyone enjoyed the salami.
Yeah.
You know, I said, because I'm not going to have it.
Doesn't mean no one's.
Absolutely.
But it's a deal of respect. Yeah. And so, you know, I see what happens in our parliament where we're now throwing punches at each other and throwing bottles at each other. Yeah. And for me, that's just a lack of respect. Right. I think we haven't learned, we've lost this ability and lost some of the tools around saying you and I can disagree fundamentally, but it doesn't have to descend into violence. It doesn't have to descend into us attacking each other.
And of course that we still miss that a little bit. I mean, even where people are trying very hard to listen, there still is a reticence, but, So, of course, you and I can carry on talking.
Yes. And you've got to go on and speak to some other interesting people.
Yes. Lots of things happening. You were reading at the libraries. You just don't stop, do you? You were at the Cape Town poetry thing.
Yeah, this morning I was at the Cape Town Central Library. Yeah.
When an opportunity is presented, can I do it? Yes, no.
Yeah. How's exactly. your father? Yeah. And most of the time it's just me reacting, people inviting me. Okay. I prefer to be sitting quietly at home reading and thinking.
Yeah.
But also I love the engagement. Yes. I think I learn by sharing ideas and interacting with others.
Yes.
And also I think that's a commitment I made. I made this commitment to public service.
Yeah.
And so to sharing ideas, inspiring others, enabling others, often just showing up. And I'm learning more and more this idea of saying, just show up. Yeah. Even if I've got nothing profound to say or any great speech, just show up and say, I care about you, whether it's in a library or it's in a school, and just be there and share something of who I am. Yeah. And I think people sense authenticity, and I hope, you know, certainly as best I can, I try and be authentic about who I am and show up with who I am.
Yeah. And if people want to help, in terms of assisting, I know Taryn, of course, does a great job, but you know, you guys are kind of managing this, and having to do all the sponsorship on your own dime.
Yeah. I mean, so if somebody really wants to help, our website is useful. So readtorise.org. And it shows there how you can help. And we're quite happy to have people help with their time or their energy and obviously financially as well.
Yeah.
And we support most of it. We don't pay ourselves much. We've got 10 full-time staff.
Mm.
But we've kept the cost as low as we possibly can, but do need help.
I wanted to talk more about India, but there you go. I'm sure if I'd pinned you down in India, we would have spoken more about it. But, you know, I think, you know, I like conversation to go where it wants.
Organically,
you know,
goes, exactly.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. So, And so these people from the UN, from the Obama Foundation, they're going to be here now.
Yeah, so in Cape Town for the next few days.
Wonderful.
It is fantastic.
Yeah.
It really is fantastic.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of them not coming with a formula.
Yeah.
They're saying, right? It's focus on the process, the procedure. Yes. How do we listen? How do we engage?
Yes.
How do we share ideas? How do we make ideas become real?
Yeah.
For me isn't a great strength. I like ideas.
Yeah.
But Taryn and the Read to Rise team and some of these Obama leaders are amazing about taking ideas and making them real.
Well, well done for doing that and getting to that point. But we have to close now.
So exactly.
Thanks, guys.
Lindsay, always fantastic speaking to you.
Wonderful. Thank you.